This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Raleigh's Oberlin Village has a proud history that goes back to its founding by former enslaved people around 1870. It's one of the first freedmen communities in the city. And for decades, it was home to carpenters, brick masons, and seamstresses. It was the launching point for several important African-American leaders like James E. Shepard and Willis Graves. Oberlin Village was indeed a thriving African-American community in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, but development and urban renewal have mostly erased it from the landscape. Efforts are underway to restore some of what's been lost and preserve the memory of the neighborhood. Writer Howard Kraft has recently created a play about Willis Graves Jr., a civil rights attorney who grew up in Oberlin Village. It's called Bending the Arc, Willis Graves Jr. and the Pursuit of Justice. Play is going to be read Thursday afternoon as part of a two-day symposium on historic preservation, Oberlin Village, and social justice. It's hosted by Preservation North Carolina, and playwright Howard Kraft joins me now to talk about the play and the legacy of Oberlin Village. Welcome back, Howard.
Good to be here, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit more about this, because you researched this community now for your work. Tell us about Oberlin Village and what it was like at its founding.
Well, Oberlin Village, first let me say I was introduced to all of this this project by Thomas Sayre, one of our great visual artists. He was constructing a memorial. He had been hired to construct a memorial by Smeeds York for the Oberlin community. And that gave me an opportunity to not only do my own research, but to actually talk to people who lived there, who knew the history as well as had lived some of the history. And the result of that was some poetry that was placed on the monument. It is a exciting story. Oberlin was founded by James H. Harris, and he's one of the founders. And it was called Oberlin because he went to Oberlin. And as you know, Oberlin was known for its abolitionists. So when he came back and they founded that village, town, part of Raleigh, they chose the name Oberlin. And it was purchased by freedmen and former slaves, $50 an acre. They bought from people who had once owned them, and created a village that was made up of artisans, carpenters, masons that would go out and basically build Raleigh. Mm. A lot of buildings you see downtown Cameron Village, a lot of those doers and workers came from the Oberlin community, and also is a community where they valued education with schools for the children and for adults too. And the people that came from there, like James E. Shepard, John Baker, the list goes on.
Well, and Willis Graves Jr. The subject of your play. So tell us about Willis Graves Jr.
Willis Graves Jr. comes from, of course, that strong legacy of great leaders from Oberlin. His father was actually Justice of the Peace. And so he grew up, and his father was also the chair of the Emancipation Day convention, where they would come back and have Emancipation Day speakers. And his father would also run for the House of Representatives. So he grew up around forward-thinking, progressive black people who were trying to, carve a world out of, being surrounded by the height of oppression. You know, this is the height of lynching. This is the height of the Ku Klux Klan. And so that formation in that environment would drive him later, after Shaw, to attend Howard Law School and to become a part of the cases that really changed the way housing works in the whole country.
Yeah, it's fascinating to think about this enclave, which does give strength and courage to the people who are living there, as you say, surrounded by a fairly hostile environment, one so hostile that Willis Graves Jr. really feels like he has to leave. He has to go to Detroit.
Yeah, I think, one of the things I say from in the piece is that every African-American who could and had the means to was trying to get out, because what we have at the end of slavery is, slavery 2.0, but now we call it Jim Crow. And
you sharecropping.
Yeah, sharecropping, which is basically the same thing, except for now it works out better for the for those who own the property, because now I no longer have to feed you. I no longer have to clothe you. That's all on you, and I can lock you to this land, and if you try to leave, you know. And we see the results around the same time. You have the massacre in Elaine, Arkansas, which is basically about black sharecroppers trying to unionize to keep from getting cheated. 237 African Americans murdered. So this is right at the heart of a very violent time to be black in this country. You know,
he goes to Detroit. He becomes an attorney, and interestingly enough, defends a landmark case in many ways in the early 20s in Detroit. Talk about that.
Yeah, we talk about that a lot in the play. Ossian Sweet case. So Ossian Sweet was a doctor from. He was from Florida, but he was at Howard's Medical School at the same time that Mr. Graves was in law school, and they became fast friends. He would even introduce Graves to his wife. And then they thought that Detroit was a place, because so many African Americans were moving to Detroit because of the automobile industry and the factory work, that, you know, these folks are going to need lawyers. These folks are going to need doctors. Right. And this is the North. You know, this is Zion. But then when they get there, they find out that there are officially 35,000 official members of the Ku Klux Klan in Detroit, and that the political system is totally infiltrated by white supremacists. And it's in this environment that his friend Ossian Sweet buys a house in this white neighborhood. And the house is surrounded by hundreds of angry white people. They start throwing things through the window, things against the house, and it's just a very few cops there. So basically, when the mob decides to take them, they're going to get taken. But Ossian Sweet had some friends and one of his family members. And when stuff started to hit the house, they started firing over the crowd. Well, one of those bullets went into the crowd and killed a man, and another man was wounded. And so everybody in the house was put on trial for murder. And so Graves was an assistant in that case and a very close friend of Ossian Sweet. So in the play, you know, this is a pivotal case for him in terms of what he will do afterwards and continue to do and the outcome of that case. And so focus a lot on that.
He wins an acquittal in Detroit in the 1920s. So this is an incredible. I tell you what, I'm talking to Howard Kraft now, who's written a play called Bending the Arc, Willis Graves Jr. in the Pursuit of Justice. The play is going to be read this afternoon at Shaw University. It's part of a 2-day symposium hosted by Preservation North Carolina. We talk about that because this attorney actually grew up in Oberlin Village, and we're talking about the rich history of that. I wonder if you could set this up and maybe read just a little piece from your play.
Sure. The play is set up in 1957. Ossian Sweet wins an award from the NAACP at their convention. This will be the same convention that Dr. King would get the Sprengon Medal. So the play is set up as what I imagine his speech might be. And this is just part of what I think he may have said in that 1957 NAACP convention speech. And so the play is centered around that, but then we flash back to different moments in his life through his speech. And so I'm going to read the part of Graves Jr. and also a little part of Mary. So hopefully we can do, you know, where people will be able to tell the difference.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is Graves Jr. There was a saying I heard growing up. I'm sure some of you are familiar with it. It goes, there's nothing the white man with a nickel hates more in this world than a Negro with a dime. So the question becomes for the Negro, do I cease to seek progress in this country? Do I cease to seek liberty in the pursuit of happiness because my happiness, my stability, my American dream is offensive to racists? No. No and no again. Too many have died. Too many have sacrificed. Too much injustice has been done. But I have been told that this America, this nation, is a nation of laws. So I decided that my role in the struggle for quality, for equality, for our people was to become a lawyer and do everything in my power to make sure those laws were working for us, to use those laws to protect us and aid us in our forward progression on this long, long road to fair treatment and human rights. walking that road has led me to my involvement in some very important cases over the years. I have worked with and learned from some of the greatest legal minds in this country, from Thurgood Marshall to Clarence Darrow. In 1945, I embarked upon a case that would be attached to the Shelley versus Kramer case, which would make its way all the way to the Supreme Court. The McGee case, like the Shelley case, came down to this, as one of McGee's relatives put it. Action moves to Mary McGee. We work every day. We pay taxes. We send our men to war when the country calls on us. We love our children and want what's best for them. We save our money. Why can't we buy houses we can pay for? Why can't we live where we want to live? Either we're Americans or we aren't. We are. We are Americans. We have been in the country longer than many European descendants, some of whom are the very people who were threatened and tried to kill us to keep us out of certain neighborhoods and housing. We are Americans. Our mothers and fathers built this land through blood, sweat, and tears under the pain of the lash and fed this nation, clothed this nation, built the very building our president resides in. And so, yes, we will live where we choose, like any other American.
Howard Kraft reading some of his work called Bending the Arc, Willis Graves Jr. in the Pursuit of Justice. Play is going to be read this afternoon at Shaw University in Raleigh as part of a two-day symposium hosted by Preservation North Carolina. I want to turn now to an institution founded in Oberlin Village called Latta University. The school was built to educate the children of freed slaves, founded by Reverend Morgan Latta in 1892. Brandi Neuwirth joins us now to tell us more. She's the great-great-granddaughter of Reverend Morgan Latta and is the chair of the Latta House Foundation. Brandi, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Tell us about this university, Latta University.
Well, Latta University was founded, as you said, in 1892 by Morgan Latta to educate the children of freed slaves. He really had this vision that education was the key to economic success for himself, his family, and his community. And what he wanted to do was create an institution where children of freed slaves could learn skills like blacksmithing, like farming, like he also trained women. They could be a seamstress. They could learn millinery. They could learn housekeeping. And we also know that he also trained teachers. He received a classical education at Shaw when he attended there and came around to be able to produce that for others to become teachers as well.
So this is a broad mandate here, and it includes not only that, but an orphanage as well.
It does. He really was responsive to his community. He could tell that when he was responding to the needs of the community. There were children without families who needed an education, who needed a place to stay. And so he created what he called the kindergarten department, which became the orphanage. And he became self-sustaining in some respect because he added arts into their curriculum. He created an orphan band, the orphanage band it was called, and they would play occasionally in places around Raleigh, and whatever funds were donated to them for their performances went right back into the orphanage to support the children.
Yes, sustaining and supporting becomes the problem. Universities support themselves by sending out very well-heeled, highly paid people, maybe highly educated or not, but anyway, they get good jobs and they come back and they donate a lot. Now, this is not what you do when you start a foundation and a university like this, right?
That's very right. Difficult. That's right. Ultimately, he had to travel quite a bit. He wrote an autobiography, which we're very lucky to have, that is online. It was done through the Documenting the South series at UNC. And his autobiography, The History of My Life and Work, he talks a lot about traveling the country, trying to raise funds for this institution, and meeting people who supported him and meeting people who also said, you're black, you can't do that. That just doesn't make sense. It's not going to work. But he didn't give up. He felt that this need was really important, and he persevered to do that. And the university lasted for 30 years.
Talk about what's left of Latta University today.
Well, what remains today is a two-acre site in the city of Raleigh in Oberlin Village. It's owned by the city of Raleigh, and we are working with the city, as we're members of a citizens planning committee, to turn the last 2 acres into a park, a park to serve the community as LADA always did.
What was the impact during the 30 years that it was a university, and as I say, much, much more, the impact on that neighborhood and Raleigh in general?
Well, the impact that the university had, we think, was pretty significant, because so many of the trades that people in Oberlin had and African Americans beyond Oberlin in Raleigh mm-hmm. had lined up with what was taught at the university, mm-hmm. right? There were all kinds of skills that were created mm-hmm. that were able to be passed on as well to descendants. So we really think that has a significant ripple effect throughout the fabric of Raleigh.
So tell me more about efforts to preserve that site now as a park.
We're really interested in making sure that the history of LADA University and of Morgan LADA is represented in the park. And we have a lot of support for that idea. We also have a lot of support we also want it to still be a very green and welcoming and serene space. It is a very special place that is open now that people can go to without it even being officially incorporated as a park.
I want to thank both of you for being on our program. Brandi Neuwirth is great-great-granddaughter of Reverend Morgan and LADA, and she's also the chair of the LADA House Foundation. You can find out more about her efforts at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you, Brandi.
Thank you.
Also, Howard Kraft, playwright and author of Bending the Arc, Willis Graves Jr. and the Pursuit of Justice. His play will be read Thursday afternoon as part of a two-day symposium on historic preservation, Oberlin Village, and social justice. And that one's hosted by Preservation North Carolina. It's at Shaw University. And, of course, we've got that information at our website, stateofthings.org, as well. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Grant Hullab-Mormon. Robin Copley is our technical director. Josie Taras is our intern. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.